to its cousin or granddaughter or whatever the other case is, the NCR Corporation against Whiting Paper Company. And I believe we will hear again from Mr. Chesler. Why don't you wait just a minute? Pardon me? Yes, right. I was going to say exactly that. I think we should hold on just a second while everyone takes their new place. Looks like we're all settled in, Mr. Chesler.
I feel like I've been here before, Your Honor.
Yes, well, you're our friend.
May it please the court, Evan Chesler for NCR. Your Honor, fundamentally, I'll cut right to the bottom line. We believe the court erred in entering the two summary judgment orders of December 09 and spring of 11.
So let me ask you, cutting to the chase on this one, what forms of discovery, what further evidence were, you know, if you can be very summary with it and cut through, you know, the thousands of pages of this record,
yes,
do you think would have been relevant and important in the district court's decision on the 113 matter?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to give you four illustrations which touch on specific evidence and four reasons. There are lots of reasons, but I've tried to cull down to four in the interest of time. Reason number one. The district court held NCR solely responsible for the period from 1954 to 1966 on summary judgment, even though the district court called that the, quote, period of general ignorance, and cited only evidence from after 1967 in support of our sole allocation of responsibility for prior to 66, and said the company that made the product is in a better position to know about the danger than the company that recycled the product.
So now, the pivot is about when Wiggins Teep, and also if I'm remembering, the Svensson report comes out.
Yes, which is in the later period, Your Honor.
Right. Yeah, that's around 67.
And so we have a situation. Yes. So we have a situation. My first point is, we have a situation in which a period that the district court found was about half the PCBs went into the river. That 12 years. District court says NCR didn't know. No one knew about dangerous PCBs. But I'm going to hold NCR solely reliable on culpability and only culpability, because they were in a better position to know something which I find they didn't know. And by doing that, the district court says, is we believe, imposing liability for an impermissible purpose under CERCLA, the mobilizer doctrine. If we're responsible for a period in which we didn't know because we made the product, that's a basis for liability that the courts do not permit. Indeed, that's what Judge Posner said in the GJ leasing case. He said if the manufacturer were responsible because somewhere down the road a harmful substance gets into the environment, nobody would ever make a car in this country because the batteries may ultimately be ending up in the environment. Mobilizers are not liable. So the error there, and the evidence that should have been considered, which we never got an opportunity to get into because it was summary judgment, is what in fact everybody knew. And let me point out one thing that other people knew at the time. The other PRPs were dumping, admittedly, tons of solid waste into the river during that period of time.
Yeah, I don't find that as helpful. And actually, I have to call you out on one thing. You know, your brief in this case began with quite an incorrect statement about the standard of review for summary judgment, because you quoted from a 1977 Seventh Circuit case that said summary judgment is a drastic remedy, shouldn't be used too often. But we have lots of cases post-Celotex, post-1986, that say not true at all. Summary judgment is a normal part of the litigation process. If the legal criteria for summary judgment are met, you know, no disputed material fact, judgment is a matter of law, it's perfectly fine. And the Supreme Court one can cite lots of cases has stuck with that. But putting that to one side, I'm trying to decide whether the problem here is the district court's decision to select one critical factor.
Right.
And, you know, he cites cases saying, you know, there's lots of discretion,
yeah.
There's no magic list. That could be a mistake in and of itself, although that wouldn't seem consistent with other cases. Or it could be a mistake, potentially, if the district court doesn't explain, you know, how it gets to that factor, why it's rejecting other potentially relevant grounds on which to allocate responsibility.
Right.
So I want to know, which is your argument?
Both. We believe, but frankly, the second one, for purposes of today, I'd like to emphasize more, that is, even within the confines of culpability, what evidence, to respond to your first question, was not considered and therefore was error on summary judgment. But I believe when the cases say that the court has broad discretion, he plainly does, the court district court does, within the context of all of the facts, a holistic view, the court has the discretion to consider which of the equitable factors it will weigh. I believe the court has to look at the other equitable factors to decide not to weigh them, however.
So you want a section of the opinion that says, here are the various things I might look at. I might look at knowledge and when it arose, and I might look at the decision to go forward in the face of increasing evidence of risk. I might look at, you want us to, or think the district court should have looked at whether companies were generally good corporate citizens when it came to environmental pollution, wholly apart from PCBs and maybe other things. I don't know, but it needs that section, and it needs somehow to say at the end of that, I don't find factors 1, 2, and 3 very helpful, so I'm going to focus on factor 4, this culpability.
Yes, Your Honor. And indeed, I've been doing this. I think you and I graduated from law school the same year. We've been doing this for a while. I've seen.
Don't remind me.
I'm afraid I just did, so I apologize. I've had lots of summary judgment cases and lots of cases after trial where it involves the district court's discretion. So many areas of the law do. And courts typically say, I'm going to exercise my discretion in the following way, and let me tell you why. And they do exactly what you've just outlined. This didn't happen here. We ended up with one factor, not with an explanation for why the others aren't part of the story, but one factor. And let me pivot and turn to my second reason, which has to do with just that factor. So let's assume for some reason you get over the hurdle of the district court considering exercising its discretion without focusing on the items it chooses in its discretion not to focus on. With respect to the second period of time, the 67 to 71 period, where
that's when it's really ramping up. It's using these things. I mean, the district judge is disturbed by this.
He is disturbed by it. And so let me cite you just a few pieces of evidence, for example, and there are others. The court says, I find, basically, NCR knew, the other people didn't know, so I'm going to weigh that one factor and find you're culpable.
He thinks NCR is increasingly aware. I want to just be as precise as possible. It's increasingly aware that there is a significant risk, maybe that the scientific evidence is mounting, that
right.
PCBs are like DDT, they're actually very bad things.
Right.
And you know, maybe that doesn't slide over into dead certain knowledge until actually after the period of this case, but the risk is really getting big.
Right. And a big part of the story, which you do not find in the district court's opinion, but for which there was evidence before the court, which the court never mentions, is that the rising awareness at the time, according to the evidence which was ignored, was that it depended upon the chlorination content of the PCBs.
Right. So this is your argument that your PCBs weren't the bad kind.
Indeed. There are notes, Your Honor, and this is at docket 667-27 in the record. Notes of a meeting in December of 69, about halfway through this latter period, of a meeting between Monsanto, which made the Araclor 1242, and NCR. In which the notes say, quote, 1242, none found to date in environment, we think it degrades, meaning it doesn't persist. It's not non-biodegradable. Those notes are nowhere referred to in the district court summary judgment opinion. And similarly, Monsanto sends a letter in the following year, in 1970, to its customers, which says, quote, PCBs with a chlorine content of less than 54% have not been found in the environment and appear to present no potential problem to the environment. That's docket 668-22, 668-23.
So let me just ask, I mean, even if there is some evidence that they may not be terrible, if what we're that's why I'm trying to focus on risk as opposed to certainty.
Right.
It's rare in these cases. Goodness, even the tobacco industry tried for years to say that the evidence wasn't entirely one-sided. So it's rare to find, for any environmentally troublesome thing, that there's absolutely no evidence, at least that people know that it's bad. So they thought maybe it wasn't. But doesn't the evidence really show that the risk, and Wiggins Teep guy finds that it's getting into the cashews, and, you know, I don't know. It seems like there's
The answer is that's what the trial should have been about. Notably, I ask you to focus on this. At the same time that the district court said the facts were enough for him to decide summary judgment against us, he carved out OU1 on the ground that what people knew and intended was a fact-intensive question on the arranger issue, and there should be a trial. Look what happened. We went to trial, and we won.
Yes.
Right? And that's going to be another subject for today. All we're saying is I'm not here to persuade you that at the end of the day, if you were the trial judge, you'd decide in our favor. I would try to persuade you, and I hope I will or would. I'm here to persuade you that we're entitled to a trial. We're entitled to get our day in court, as we did on the arranger issue. And it's ironic that the court drew this distinction on two what's-in-your-head issues. He said, I think NCR knew about a rising risk. I'm going to ignore the fact that their manufacturer told everybody that it was not a risk for the Arachlor that they were selling. I'm going to ignore the fact that the manufacturer told them in a meeting that this one didn't persist in the environment. Not that I weigh that evidence and I decide I persuaded more by the other side's evidence than yours. That's what trials are for. We never got our day for a trial in this case, and that, I submit to Your Honors, is error. We should have gotten our trial. Let me give you one other example in the interest of time. The district court says that based on the evidence that in the late 60s, PCBs, quote, were a dangerous environmental toxin, quote, it may readily be inferred, unquote, that NCR would know the PCBs would go from the mills into the environment. Now, at that time, the facts show NCR had no facilities on the Fox River. It subsequently bought ACPC, Appleton Coated, and combined locks.
So it's an emulsion. I mean, it's making an emulsion,
right?
For the paper. So what's
wrong? NCR was selling it to ACPC, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And they were coating the paper, and then the recyclers were buying the broke, and it was going into the river. Now here's my.
So an emulsion is going to. I mean, they're not going to just put it in tanks.
But Your Honor, this is my point. The court drew an inference on summary judgment that because the PCBs were a dangerous environmental toxin, a fact which we dispute, as I just said, because the evidence that said we didn't think it was ignored, that it may readily be inferred. I don't believe district courts are supposed to draw adverse inferences on summary judgment. He did explicitly infer that NCR would know that the PCBs would go into the recycling mills and then into the wastewater. Now, what was the NCR facility on the river at that time? It was ACPC. Right. Our only liability here is successor liability to having bought them.
Which you agree exists under CERCLA.
Absolutely. So what did the district court find in the arranger case about whether ACPC knew at that time that it was going into the river? He found they didn't know. So he drew an adverse inference on summary judgment about our knowledge based upon our predecessor, ACPC, which he found was 180 degrees wrong when he, in fact, tried the case in the Ranger case. He found that ACPC did not know that these were going into the river, that they didn't know what the wastewater treatment capabilities of the recyclers were. They didn't know that, in fact, the city's sewage systems weren't going to keep these things out of the river. That was after a 7-day trial. So my point is simply, again, we should have gotten a trial, not whether we ultimately are right or we're wrong. He drew inferences against us. He even found credibility about witnesses who never appeared before him. He found this one witness, Schneider's testimony, wouldn't have been credited by a jury. He never saw Mr. Schneider. He never met Mr. Schneider. It was deposition testimony on a summary judgment motion, Your Honor. And I take your point, and I apologize for overstating or understating the unusual nature of summary judgment. But I would submit, Your Honor, that under any standard of summary judgment, when the defendants in this case file a brief here that says the evidence in their view is weak, talking about the ignored evidence about Monsanto, and it's conflicting. That's their word from their brief in this case. At least as I learned the way this works, when you have conflicting evidence, when one side says the evidence is weak and the other side says, no, it's strong, you get a trial.
You do, as long as it's a material dispute.
Absolutely. And since, to go back to where Your Honor started, of all the possible things the district court could have looked at, he chose only one, which we think he shouldn't have done, at least without telling us why he didn't choose the others. When you go to that one, surely that was material. The entire case turned on this fulcrum of culpability. And on culpability, he ignored the evidence that said we were assured by the people making the product that it was not a danger. We should have been able to prove that. We should have been able to develop that evidence. We think it's wrong. May I go to Arranger, unless you have other questions?
Yes, sorry.
So let me turn to the question of Arranger. Believe what the defendants do on Arranger liability is they take a series of factual determinations that the court made and try to cast them as legal standards. I understand why, because the standard for review is much more forgiving for a legal standard. But I don't believe that's what the district court did, and I think the opinion makes that clear. He made a series of factual findings. He found, for example, that ACPC, Appleton Coated, lacked knowledge, as I said before, that the broke could be hazardous or that it was in fact going into the river after being treated by the recycling systems of the recycling companies.
But, you know, on Arranger, one of the lines that has to be drawn is whether you're just, you know, having somebody else get rid of something for you. I mean, the broke was a waste product. There's no doubt about it. You need to trim off the ends of these rolls and so on. And from your point of view, it was a waste product. And I vaguely remember reading somewhere in this mountain of stuff that it wasn't really even all that lucrative to sell. You got some money for it, of course, but not that much. So why is getting rid of your waste in a way, just because you found somebody else who wants to buy it, not just disposing of it?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, this is one of those mixed product cases, like the GJ Leasing case was, the power plant that had some good stuff in it and also had some asbestos in it, like a number of the other cases that have been cited in the briefs. In those situations, the fact that there is a hazardous material included within the product has to be looked at the time the product was sold, and the question, as Judge Posner posed it in the leasing case, with which I agree, is, what was the primary purpose? Those were his words. What was the primary purpose? Otherwise, you'd never be able to sell a product with mixed components and avoid CERCLA liability. Just as he said, who would ever make a car if when you sell the car, you know that the battery has hazardous substance in it? So first point is...
But that goes too far. I mean, it's like, you know, when you... You're polishing a car and there are metal scraps on the floor or something. You're trying to pick up those metal scraps and then you give them to an aluminum recycler or something. I mean, it's your waste. It's not...
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. But that's not our facts here. Our facts here are that the company invested, ACPC invested a lot of money in how to handle its broke. In fact, sold it into an extraordinarily competitive market because for a century, literally for 100 years, the paper recycling industry recognized that it was cheaper to make paper from paper than it was to make paper from wood. So it isn't, respectfully, Your Honor, that they found somebody who would take it off their hands. If you look at the testimony of Wally Bergstrom, for example, the predecessor to the Glatfelter ownership, he said this was an intensely competitive market. He would be calling brokers all the time to make sure he had a supply of broke available because that was the engine that drove the recycling business. Now,
Does the record show the price that people get for this broke?
Yes, I don't have it in my mind right now, but yes, it does. It showed that the market had been developed for literally a century, that it was always treated as an asset on the books of ACPC, not as garbage, that ACPC invested a lot of money to sort it, bail it, have it shipped away. They didn't pay a carter to throw the garbage away the way you and I do to pay the local sanitation company. They were paid. And in fact, although it wasn't enormously profitable, it was profitable. They made more money coming back for the broke than it cost them to handle the broke and process the broke and get rid of it. It was, in fact, a useful product. It was not, in fact, garbage in the sense of the Arranger cases that treat waste for that purpose.
So would you say you only have that if you... If you're getting somebody to take it off to a landfill or to burn it or...
No, I would not. If it were, in fact, that's one of the findings the court made. This wasn't dumped in landfills.
No, I understand. So you're saying, I'm just trying to see the corollary of what you're saying.
Sure.
That it would be a waste product if and only if it goes to a landfill or an incinerator, or do you have a broader definition?
No, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. No, I don't think it necessarily has to be synonymous with going to a landfill, or that would be a probative piece of evidence, but it doesn't have to be. You have to take all of the facts into consideration, which is what the judge did. You have to look at what was the nature of this market, what were in fact people doing with the product that they were buying, what were they using it for, and what was, here's the ultimate question, which the judge focused on, what was the intent when you made that transaction with all of those brokers? What were you trying to do?
So you're trying to sell the broke. I get that. But some of the cases seem to imply, at the same time, you are, in fact, disposing of the hazardous component of it. Somebody has
it's
to.
Going with, yes,
yes,
part of the broke.
Going along with the product.
Yes, absolutely. You are. And, Your Honor, that's why I say this is. There are cases that are purely a perfectly benign product that isn't ever going to hurt anybody, and you sell it, somebody has a use for it, and they use it. There are cases where you're carting away toxic barrels full of really smelly and dangerous stuff, and everybody knows all you're trying to do is get it off your property. And then there are a number of cases in between where it is a useful product. It has something in it that's hazardous, but it's a useful product. That's why this judge said it was an intense fact question. It all went to the intent of ACPC in disposing of the product. We had days of trial, 4,000-plus exhibits, 15 or so witnesses, and the court made a series of findings which were not an articulation of the legal standard. They were findings that informed the legal standard, which was, what was the intent when the product was sold? Was it an intent to dispose of a hazardous substance, or was it intent to sell something that in fact had a use? And that was a fact question, and in the absence of a finding that it was a clearly erroneous fact question, he applied the right legal standard. The facts were plainly not clearly erroneous, and we submit that judgment ought to stand.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Sullivan. No? Oh, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to cut you off, Mr. Ragatz.
Mr. Ragatz, yes.
Ragatz.
My client would have liked to have been left out of this case
time
ago.
we want you here, so proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Ron Ragatz. I'm here representing Appian, which was at one time named Appleton Papers, Inc., and which you will see referred to in
quite a few incarnations, hasn't it? With
yes.
Commas and without commas. And
yeah.
Yes.
But the with comma was not my client.
Oh.
Without comma is my client. You'll see it referred to uniformly as API in the briefs.
We should probably at this point refer to it as Appian, though, if that's what it is.
You will probably have to correct me during the course of the oral argument.
I'm not going to correct you, but I'm just warning you when you see an opinion, it will probably say Appian.
Fair enough, Your Honor. So I'm here today in the unique position of representing the only PRP designated by the government who has been determined not to have any liability under CERCLA. The government initially designated API, now Appian, as a PRP in 1996. Unfortunately, API could not challenge that designation at that point or any of the subsequent orders issued by EPA because of CERCLA's bar on pre-enforcement review. And so that was not lifted until 2010 in the enforcement action that you've just heard about. At the first opportunity, API challenged the notion that it was liable under CERCLA, and in April of 2012, it prevailed in that challenge.
So there's a period of time, though, from the time when it's designated as a PRP to when it's finally held by the district court to be off the hook, that it's paying some costs of various kinds, right?
Yes, Your Honor. 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it incurred lots of costs, lots of response costs during that time. For instance, $170 million in complying with the 106 order that was issued to API and others. And, of course, not being able to challenge its designation as being liable under CERCLA and being potentially exposed to fines of $37,000 a day and treble damages was not a risk that a company like API was in a position to take. And so they did what Congress wants parties like API to do when they've set up the no pre-enforcement review and the severe penalties, which is respond now with the promise that if it turns out down the road when we get to the litigation stage that you don't have liability or that you have paid more than you should have, you will have a remedy at that point.
So it's in a funny position because with hindsight, according to the district court again, it should not have been designated as a PRP. So in hindsight, I'm understanding you to be arguing that it's really in the position of a voluntary actor in this participation in the cleanup, the $170 million or whatever it is, and thus I understand you'd be saying that's how it can use 107A, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Except that it wasn't quite, it certainly wasn't voluntary during the years that it thought it was a PRP. So 107 is a funny fit in this world where the Supreme Court is telling us somehow to draw a line between 113 and 107. And if you, because of the indemnity agreement, if you stand in the shoes of NCR, is it your position that you can't pursue a 113 remedy on your own behalf?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason for that is what's set forth in Atlantic Research, which is if in order to be able to pursue a 113, two things have to be present. One, there has to be a statutory trigger, and for instance, the enforcement action in this case would be a statutory trigger.
So we have a trigger, for sure.
Second is you have to have common liability. And the common liability is the essence of a contribution action. That's why, that's when you get to comparing the relative fault or responsibility, you need that common liability to do it. If you don't have that common liability, if you don't have a 113 action, then the Supreme Court said in Atlantic Research you have a 107 action, which is, or 107 claim, which is what we asked the district court to allow.
So the question really is, and I guess there are the cases that involve insurance companies, and you're not really in the same position as they have been in.
Correct.
Since there was the PRP designation, but whether common liability, as that term is used, could somehow be triggered through contractual networks as well as through the more conventional joint and several liability.
I don't think common liability would be triggered through a private settlement agreement with one party. And in fact, I think in the Aguirre case, where the party pursuing 107 had a settlement with liable parties, the court nonetheless allowed it to pursue a 107 claim.
I will say that, you know, in principle, I'm sympathetic to your argument that there ought to be some box or another under which you can at least seek seek country. You know, whatever happens would happen, but that it ought to be something.
And that's what
that's
brings.
What I'm understanding you to be saying.
That's what brings us here today, Your Honor.
Yeah.
The insurance case, Chubb, that you mentioned.
Chubb. Yeah.
There are critical differences. Not only that that API was pursued aggressively by the government directly as a PRP, but also that API paid the costs contemporaneously. It undertook and managed the remediation contemporaneously, as Congress intended with 106. None of that applied to Chubb. And if you find, if one takes the analysis from Chubb and applies it to the circumstance of API, which is paying the cost contemporaneously, having been pursued by the government, undertaking the remediation, under the analysis in Atlantic Research, which Chubb followed, that party has incurred response costs. That party, therefore, is eligible for a 107 claim. So, actually, applied to these facts, Chubb supports our claim. I believe Atlantic Research supports API's claim, and I think believe Aguirre supports API's claim. So, we would first and foremost believe that API should be able to pursue a 107 claim.
So I take it you're talking about, you've indicated that this claim runs against all the other participants in this mess.
responsible parties, yes, Your Honor.
All the other PRPs.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. And so,
even though you're not a PRP anymore.
We.
I mean, you're defending that. I realize there's
we're defending
issue
that. Right.
About that,
the government
that
is still pursuing us 18 years later.
The government thinks you should be, yes.
The other point that I would like to make is part of the district court's rationale for denying a 107 claim is that, well, you can just pursue subrogation to NCR's rights.
Right, yeah.
First of all, I do not believe that that is a proper basis to deny a 107 claim. If you look at the analysis in Atlantic Research, I believe in this court's Bankert decision and many other, the consideration for saying that you either have a 113 or a 107. So 113 was adopted in the SARA amendments in 1986. You don't want that to get effectively swallowed by 107 claims. That rationale doesn't apply to 112.
Right, that implies that you do have the 107 claim. I mean, obviously, if you lose in the government's argument and you're back in as a PRP, you would agree that that makes it easy to use, or not easy, but it makes 113 the correct vehicle.
If that someday turns out to be the case, but of course I'm here addressing what we are here for today. And I would add just quickly with respect to the subrogation claim, we agree with NCR that granting of summary judgment was inappropriate. We have also addressed that topic because that's part of what means we have no subrogation claim, mm-hmm. Including the emphasis on the mobilizer theory, which I do not believe is proper under CERCLA policy. And I see at this point
your time is up.
On.
Yes,
I
you want to say something.
I will reserve the remainder.
All right. Thank you. Now it's your turn, Ms. Sullivan.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Kathleen Sullivan for the NCR versus Whiting Appellees. I'd like to begin with why the summary judgment allocating 100% of response costs to NCR in the contribution action was entirely proper and should be affirmed. Now, to begin with, Chief Judge Wood, you asked, was the error in application of the statute in picking one factor on which to rest response cost allocation, culpability or relative fault, was that improper? And the answer to that question is clearly no. Not only does the statute, by its terms, entitle the district court to allocate response costs among liable parties using such equitable factors as the court determines are appropriate. Congress couldn't have delegated the choice of factors more broadly to the district court. But this court held in Environmental Transportation Services against ENSCO that privileging one factor, even at summary judgment, is entirely appropriate. This court said that a district court may consider under 113F1 several factors, a few factors, or only one determining factor, as the district court did in that case. And, of course,
right.
ETS on its facts found fault, relative fault, the sole factor, and didn't look to other evidence.
Which is why I asked the other part of the question, because, as you well know, abusive discretion standards of review occur in many areas of the law, and it doesn't mean a rubber stamp. I mean, we even review things like Federal Rule of Evidence 403 decisions on abuse of discretion, and that there's huge discretion on the part of the district court. But we need to know why. We need to know there's some reason given, or you can't even give abuse of discretion review. And so my concern is whether the district judge jumped too quickly to this relative fault idea without taking the time to explain why other factors didn't need to be considered.
And the answer to that, too, Your Honor, is the district court absolutely did consider and state his reasons for rejecting the other factors. And if I could refer you specifically to the portions of his December 2009 opinion at pages A 239 to 40, he says, I will consider fault. I will also consider the Gore factors, and he enumerates them.
Right.
And then in his 2011 decision, granting the contribution claims by the defendants, if I could refer you to pages A-286 to 288, he there goes into quite a bit of detail about how I've considered other factors like volumetric discharge were supposed post-71 discharges by the defendants once they have knowledge. And I have rejected those. And the reason he rejects them is he finds them insufficient to counterbalance the relative fault disparity that he finds so crucial. And he's explained that at very great length. So in answer to your second question, did he explain his rejection of the other factors? He did, A2 39 to 40 and A2 86 to 88. Now, Your Honor, that leads us to the question of whether there are any disputed material issues of fact.
Or did he cut off discovery too quickly? Because it seems to me that the NCR parties did tell the district court there were additional points on which facts could be gleaned. I, for example, have a concern about that earliest period, the 1953 to 67 period. If everybody was blithely going around, you know, with an empty mind and a clean heart, then I don't see why NCR has to pay all of it.
Well, Your Honor, that's not what the record shows. The record shows asymmetry of knowledge even in the 54 to 67 period, and I can be specific on that in a moment. But let me just address your methodological question first. Did the district court cut off discovery too soon? The answer to that is no. If you look at the case management order at page A203, what A203 entitles the parties to very broad discovery as to knowledge of risk. And, Your Honor, Chief Judge Wood, you hit the nail on the head before when you said the key to the equities in this case was not certainty about environmental harm from PCBs. The key to the equity balancing in this case, as the district court himself said on page A244, was relative knowledge about risk, relative knowledge about potential environmental harm. And that was known even in the 54 to 61 period, but that's in the CMO. That's the discovery was allowed on relative knowledge about risk.
But I recall something in the record, I think it's a paper institute or something, that indicates that these recycling companies, and I'll just call them that in general, whether they're dealing with the broke, whether they're dealing with the post-consumer materials, did have some knowledge that there was risk in the PCBs, and I'm worried about deliberate, you know, the ostrich effect, if you will, deliberately not learning that this emulsion, that this particular substance is toxic.
Okay, Your Honor, generally one does worry about that under CERCLA. The policy is to go after dischargers, whoever they may be. But here we have the rare instance in which the policy of CERCLA is being fulfilled. We have cleanup being undertaken by a solvent party. The government has succeeded in producing the remediation that CERCLA wants to produce. Now we're at the table trying to divide up the response costs. And what we have here, as the district court properly found, is one party, NCR, who had profoundly asymmetric knowledge of the risk and the potential for harm.
But they're responsible for less than half of the quantity.
But that,
the other people are kind of in the, it's a 60-40 split, roughly speaking.
Well, correct, Your Honor, and we don't dispute that. But the point is, as the district court found, who is culpable for that discharge? If the discharge by the paper recyclers that's going into the river, and remember 40% is coming from ACPC's creation of the paper using the emulsion, but it, the volumetric discharge, as the district court found, isn't dispositive of relative contribution where the knowledge and culpability is so different. And let me address, Your Honor, your question of whether the recyclers, the paper mills, knew something about PCB risks.
Yeah.
And this is really the key to why the summary judgment ruling is correct. There is no material dispute of fact as to the most important factor here, which is the innocence of the defendants in relation to PCBs. The defendants are the paper mills that are recycling the broke, discharging PCBs into the river as part of the effluent from cleaning the paper of the non-fiber substances. They are ignorant, and there was nothing that the NCR evidence was able to do to put that into dispute. And the district court considered and rejected each of the attempts to say, oh, they must have known. And I can knock these off in order, Your Honor. It's all covered at page A245 to 247. A245 to 247 of the district court's 2009 opinion, he says, well, did the recyclers know something from a January 1971 American Paper Institute letter? No, they didn't, because there was no evidence that any of the defendants ever received that letter. And the citation to Mr. Austin, a Menasha employee, as to his supposed memory of PCBs being in the right. recycled material, he repudiated it. Second, the only other things that NCR put into evidence were a 1976 Institute of Paper Chemistry
right,
report.
The district court says that's too many years later.
Post facto, no evidence. And the testimony of a Fort Howard employee that a Monsanto press release in 1970 would have mentioned NCR's paper. It didn't.
If NCR and the recycling defendants were equally ignorant up until this Svensson report and the other serious information starts, the work that's being done in the UK. So for much more than half the period, but maybe half of the discharges, why does that justify summary judgment, number one, and why does that justify giving NCR 100% of the responsibility?
Okay. First of all, the premise is incorrect. There was not equal ignorance from 54 to 71. From 54 to 67.
67.
When the Jensen report comes out in 66 and goes into NCR's files in 1967. There was not equal ignorance then, Your Honor. The undisputed evidence shows that NCR knew that emulsion contained the Monsanto product that went into its emulsion, and therefore its emulsion contained PCBs. It's undisputed that's known from 1954.
But do they know that PCBs are the dangerous things that we now recognize them to be? I mean, you could say the paper had ink on it, too, and if the ink is soy-based, it's not something you'd worry about.
But no, Your Honor, they know that it's toxic. They have asymmetric information that it's toxic, it's harmful to human health, it's irritant to skin. That's docket 667 to 16. That's known from 1954.
That's this defatting
factor. The defatting factor, Your Honor. But put that to one side. Let's go to the second reason why the district court acted properly in deeming for the entire production period the relative fault to lie entirely with NCR. And that is because the delta in knowledge and culpability is so great from 67 to 71. And there is no ability, as you've been discussing earlier, to distinguish for remediation purposes the sediments that go into the river before and after 67. It was proper to attribute to the entire period the relative culpability differences that are established in 67 to 71. 67 to 71, there's no doubt, I don't think I need to belabor this, Your Honor, that the culpability difference there is overwhelmingly established. There are no material differences, no material factual disputes over the relative ignorance of the defendants relative to the increasing knowledge of NCR. And let's be clear here that the evidence the district court reviews at great length is not just that NCR knew now of the toxicity of PCBs and their biopersistence, their inability to be degraded in the environment, and therefore their ongoing harm to the environment. Not only is that knowledge clear from 67 to 71, Your Honor alluded to it before, 1969, NCR and Monsanto begin to get together to discuss the Jensen report. And then it's not just the knowledge, it's the cover-up. NCR affirmatively asks Monsanto not to divulge to the United Kingdom government that NCR paper contains, carbonless copy paper, contains PCBs. They do it twice. They do it in a meeting in January of 1970 and again in March of 1970 against the wishes of their licensee in England. So it's the combination from 67 to 71 of asymmetric knowledge about the environmental harm from PCBs and their persistence and the attempt to cover up that knowledge that leads the district court to say in the key passage, Your Honor, that you alluded to before, that there was disregard of red flags, there was knowledge of risk and the potential for environmental liability. That's at A244. And, Your Honor, that's why everything that Mr. Chesler said before about, well, we were lulled into thinking that maybe 1242 wasn't as bad as 1254, and maybe our...
He actually said something stronger than that. He said we were lulled into thinking that the type that we had was going to biodegrade.
Well, Your Honor, there's countervailing evidence, obviously, that the district court...
Then you might weigh that. You may, that gets us to the summary judgment point.
I hear you, Your Honor, but let me... I want to... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No. Agreeing with the point that my colleague just made.
I don't want to just say that the conflicting evidence, obviously there's conflicting evidence. There's two sets of handwritten notes on the from the 1970 meeting. We can point to errors and they can point to errors. What I don't want to focus on that conflict. What I want to focus on is why it was immaterial. And, Your Honor, you're quite right. You were quite right at the outset to remind Mr. Chesler that we do allow summary judgment even when there are some disputed issues of fact. And we know from the teaching of Anderson versus Liberty Lobby that you can't just allege disputes of fact. They have to be material. They have to be facts that are significantly probative.
And that's why I was worried about the district judge's then, I'll just say, explanation as to why this one factor of relative culpability, when it seems to me that maybe it tips a little bit toward liability for NCR for the 53 to 67 period, maybe it tips much more strongly to the later period, but I feel as though I haven't been given the reason why this is going to be such a strong and determinative factor that it leads to this result. Why we don't need a further factual examination?
Because, Your Honor, it's extremely rare that we have at the table a party that was so knowledgeable about the risk and potential for environmental harm, actively concealed that, not just from the UK authorities, but never disclosed it to any American authorities, but most important, and this is key, never stopped ACPC, its business partner, who was turning its emulsion into carbonless copy paper and sending it back, never told them, we know there's PCBs in the emulsion we're selling you to coat your paper with, that you are then going to wash into the river. Never told them, never stopped them, never said maybe the broke should go to a landfill.
But they do stop in 1971. They're not required to.
But, Your Honor, where the district court focused, and here if you look at let me be quite clear here that Mr. Chesler said, oh, well, the district court turned this into manufacturer liability and a kind of product liability case. Not so. The district court held that NCR was culpable here, not just because it manufactured the emulsion. To the contrary, the district court held NCR morally culpable here because it did not stop the PCBs from going through the recycling, the production process and the recycling process into the river when it was the only party with the knowledge to do so. It was the least cost avoider. And, Your Honor, if I could focus you on pages A252 and 256, there you'll see the district court is not relying on a manufacturer theory. He's relying on the point that, as he says on 256, NCR never stopped ACPC from flooding the river with PCBs when it was uniquely able to do so.
I mean, do you have a theory of
67 at a minimum, Your Honor? But the point is, once you're dredging, you can't distinguish the 1954 PCBs from the 1968 PCBs.
I guess that's right. Mr. Oakley said something in the last argument that all of a sudden made me think that you could distinguish between the older and the newer ones. But I didn't. I'm not the expert.
Well, Your Honor,
here,
I'm not going to go there. But what I do want to suggest is that you held in this court held in the ETS versus ENSCO case, that relative fault, a traditional equitable consideration, is a legitimate basis for allocating 100% of liability to one party where that party is overwhelmingly at fault. There, the trucker making the fast turn. Here, an NCR who knew about PCBs, certainly knew by the later period about their toxicity, their persistence, and their harm to the environment. And crucially, the most important point here is that they didn't stop ACPC from producing the paper, and they didn't stop ACPC from selling to the recyclers the broke, which they knew, of course, because recycling, as Mr. Chesler tried to argue to you, was an important part of the business model of ACPC, knew would go into the river.
Now, didn't Menasha, if I'm remembering correctly, actually build a facility that eliminated most of the PCBs from its own wastewater?
Well, Your Honor, there were changes in production later in the period.
The only reason I ask that is because I wonder whether that sheds any, you know, or whether that would support an inference that they were actually also worried that there might be something bad about this stuff.
Your Honor, the district court did consider and reject all the other factors. It considered volumetric discharge. It considered the ongoing recycling after 1971 and said it was negligible.
Right.
It considered the fact that there were subsequent EPA and Wisconsin regulations that permitted the post-consumer waste discharges right. after 71. So, Your Honor, if you're concerned about whether the district court gave reasons for not reaching the other factors, he did so. And I think it would turn ETS on its head to say that a district court has to have a full trial on every imaginable factor. Why create that extra cost and expense when, in fact, there was substantial opportunity through the discovery process to talk about relative risk? And the district court made quite a detailed explanation of why he emphasized fault above other things. With my limited time, could I turn briefly to API's attempt to resurrect its 107 claim and just briefly explain why neither NCR nor API should be permitted to resurrect a 107 claim?
You're welcome to do that. I will say again, as I said to Mr. Regetz, that what worries me is that they are treated as a PRP for a long time. They pay a lot of money, and yet suddenly, unlike either a real volunteer or somebody who's acting under an order of some type and thus available to use 113, they seem to be just out the money without any ability to pursue anything.
So two answers to that, Your Honor. They are not out of the money without any ability to pursue anything. As you noted before, they're subrogated to NCR's rights, and they have a contractual and arbitral arrangement for sharing responsibility with NCR. So they're not out to the extent they're subrogated in anything.
So you see, there's a private contract action they bring against NCR?
Exactly. That's exactly right. But there's a second remedy they have as well, Your Honor, and that, if I could just remind you, they have a Superfund remedy. They can go under 106 back to the government and say, well, excuse us, but we were asked to pay more than our fair share. And, in fact, they did so, and, in fact, it was deemed unripe, but there's no obstacle to their coming back at a later point and asking for that money back from the government. So there's no reason to say that API is completely without remedy here, or Appian. But also, Your Honor, there's a very important point here about the litigation strategy here. API and NCR went into this case together. They had a litigation marriage, so to speak. They came into the action as a team. They litigated and lost together a Section 113 claim. They didn't have to come in together, but they did. And the district court considered that, and if I could refer you to A224.
Okay, and then you'll need to wrap up.
Right. A224 note 8, the district court considered that the district court says, I do not see any distinction between these parties. They had an opportunity to get a divorce then. They didn't. And therefore, as a matter of litigation history, you should treat the 107 claims as out of API just as out of luck as NCR on the 107 claims. So you should affirm with respect to all issues on appeal. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome back, Mr. Mandelbaum.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to address first the arranger issues. Mr. Chesler is correct that the issue is what was the intent of that transaction. So you have a material that is not usable to anybody in the form in which it exists. It's paper scraps. It's not going to a confetti dealer. In order to be usable, it has to be disassembled, completely disassembled. The usable part has to be extracted, and the unusable part has to be discarded. So there's an intention in that transaction to do that disassembly and that disposal.
So let me ask you this. I have two hypotheticals for you. One of them is, actually, I need to use some state like the state of Maine that still collects aluminum cans,
yes, ma'am.
You know, grocery stores. Most states don't do it that way, but Maine is Maine. So that needs to be substantially, the waste cans that people have finished drinking their soda from need a lot of reprocessing, too, before they can be made into new products. So would you say that that's disposal, or that's just selling aluminum in a different form?
This is the point we made about Section 127, the Superfund Recycling Equity Act. That issue was resolved by Congress by giving that activity in almost all circumstances involving something like aluminum cans an exemption, because it could have been arranging for disposal, but Congress decided it should be encouraged and would not be permitted.
So I can think of all sorts of manufacturing processes where the raw materials that go into the production of the product in question are not used up 100%. There's leftover. I was even thinking of agricultural uses where, you know, there's scrap meat and you send it off to a cat food plant or something like that. And nobody wants the scrap meat. It's not fit for human consumption, but the cats think it's fine. So all of these things strike me as things where the leftovers from company A are actually a useful input for company B. And I'm hard-pressed to see why this isn't a situation like that.
Because leftovers for company A, if they're not usable in the form that they come out of company A, and have to be reprocessed.
Why is it bad that they're, as they're used as an input, that there's some reprocessing?
Why is it even significant, I guess? It's not bad. It's that the intention is to separate. It's the battery breaker case. It's the difference between a battery breaker who has to break open the plastic case, remove the lead plates, and discard the battery. Right? The person who sells to the battery breaker is arranging for disposal of whatever gets disposed in that process, because that's fundamentally a disposal arrangement.
Right, that's a disposal and salvage kind of arrangement. And I guess I'm having trouble seeing this as disposal and salvage of whatever is useful in the paper.
It's paper fibers, Your Honor. It's 60 to 80%. So that means 20 to 40% is being discarded. And particularly the material that's being discarded includes the very coating that Appleton Coated Paper Company put on the paper.
It's that coating, but it's inks, it's color, you know, it's
that's right, but they know what's going on, and it's not usable otherwise, right? There's when
you recycled paper is a huge industry. It's
that's correct, Your Honor, and that's why the Superfund Recycling Equity Act, in general, exempts paper recycling. This is not exempt because it contains PCBs in excess of 50 parts per million. Okay, so that it's the recycling is specifically permitted as not arranging for disposal, subject to certain due diligence obligations and so on and so forth. But this is not. And that's because otherwise recycling operations like this are arranging for disposal.
So I don't know. I mean, it still seems to me that there are a set of companies that don't use everything. I mean, you know, dress manufacture, you know, you cut the fabric and then there's fabric left over and somebody might like the ends of the fabric bolts and they'll make something else. They'll make toys out of it or something.
If it's going to be used as fabric, then arguably it's not arranging for disposal. If, however, the process involves disassembling the fabric into threads and reweaving the...
Now you make paper out of it.
Yeah. then it is arranging for disposal if you have to discard the unusable parts.
So you're assuming, though, that, I mean, I guess what we have to look into is what the definition of disposal is, because there are a number of definitions floating around out there. Some of them are, you know, is this really just trying to send this thing to its final resting place, you know, or, you know, like your battery example, you pull out a few useful metals, but you're basically trashing the thing, or is it a more flexible test?
There's a potential use for everything that's discarded, because the matter doesn't go away, right?
No, not really. I mean, landfill isn't a use, I would say.
Well, but Your Honor, landfills are used to support. Landfills are used to make methane gas. Many landfills pick through the trash and remove recyclable parts or reusable parts. Some transfer stations pull out reusable parts. We encourage whole industries to do that because if it's better to reuse it, you reuse it. And there are some operations that have gone on, not recently, but within the past 20 years, where people have actually gone into a landfill, excavated the landfill, and burned it for energy. Right? So that to say that there's no conceivable further use and only that is disposal restricts disposal to a little tiny set of activities. In fact, if it's waste to you, and the district court found that this was waste to ACPC,
right,
and you're discarding it by doing something which you intend to involve throwing away something, whatever gets thrown away, you arrange to dispose.
So throw away, though, is kind of a conclusory word, it strikes me. You know, you have your production process and most of it winds up being a roll of this coated paper and some of it can't be used for the coated paper, but your business model involves selling out to somebody else who wants it and who's going to find some use for it.
That's right. And but they're not using it as it is. They're disassembling it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're throwing away, they're recovering one component and discarding the rest. And that when you
don't really care that they're doing that. As far as you're concerned, they could use the whole thing.
Yes, but you're in the paper business. You understand what's going on. And it's not necessary that you understand that it's going to go out into the river or exactly how it's going to work. You know that you're selling coated paper. You're selling coated paper scraps. And what they're making are rolls of uncoated paper. You know that the material is going someplace. It's not disappearing. And therefore, you are arranging for that going someplace. Otherwise, the battery cases don't make any sense. Otherwise, the solder dross cases don't make any sense. The rule, the application of the new and useful product doctrine to this kind of transaction is a complete red herring because it's not new, right? It's old. It's been used. And it's not useful in its present form. The question here is whether this is someone taking a piece of furniture that's broken that I leave on the street to repair it and reuse it, or whether they intend to disassemble it and totally to its component parts and make something totally different with it, or with parts of it, right? And to discard some. If it's the latter, it's arranging for disposal. If it's the former, it's reuse. And this is clearly not reuse. They knew.
It's reuse of the paper fibers, actually.
Yes.
You know, you don't have to go cut down another tree for this
paper. But this case is not about the paper fibers. This case is about the coating. And the coating, there's no intention of anybody to reuse that coating.
Nobody wants to reuse. I agree with you there.
Right.
You
know? Does it matter to you whether the majority of the scrap or broke is reused in something else, or whether it's a smaller percentage than the majority?
Well, no, I don't think it's necessary that it be a majority. It's necessary that some part of it is intended to be discarded.
Right? However small?
Well, this is not that small. I don't know where the line is, Your Honor, but this is 20 to 40%. That's what the district court found. That's what the evidence said. And that is, the unit of disposal is an 80-ton rail car load. So that's, I'm gonna mess up my math, 16 to 32 tons of material in that rail car loader intended to be discarded.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Last, Mr. Gualtieri.
Good morning. May it please the Court, David Gualtieri from the U.S. Department of Justice on behalf of the United States. I would like to address quickly a couple of comments or a couple of the responses from Mr. Ragatz to your question on the API liability issue. I believe you asked him if it was possible by matter of contract to become a liable party to third parties under CERCLA or to the United States for that matter. I believe you said no, and the answer, of course, is that
yes,
you certainly
actually
can. North Shore Gas, Harley-Davidson. Here we have a case of successor liability and a contractual assumption of liability.
So is it the position of the United States that they can just go right ahead and join the 113 or bring a 113 action?
Well, our position is, first of all, that they're not entitled to a Section 107 action. At the time,
I asked you about 113
yes,
because
at the time
I thought
that API and NCR were both sued in 2001 by the United States with respect to the entire site. That
right.
triggered an action for response costs as to the entire site as to both of them. That
so you
trigger
say once in, always in, even if the district court, maybe not even in this case, in any case, if the district court erroneously designates somebody as a PRP and they pay for a while and it's upheld all the way up to the Supreme Court, you say tough luck? You know,
well, it's not tough luck. There is a trigger in the statute. The statute does not provide for the circumstance that we're dealing with here and doesn't suggest that if there's later a finding of no liability or if there's, in the case of arguments NCR makes, there's later a consent decree resolving the case that's narrower than the original case, giving a separate right of contribution under Section 113F3B, that somehow the trigger has now been diminished. You have less of a claim or you have no claim at all. That's simply not the case. The trigger is what matters. The trigger was met when they were sued as to the entire site. They brought their contribution action, and that is the claim that they have. Now, it took Mr. Ragatz a long time to get around to it, but I was wondering if he was going to get to the issue of subrogation, which was the sole basis of the district court's opinion. In the case of API, distinct from NCR, where here we would say NCR has a claim as to the entire site, always has had a claim as to the entire site, including OU1 and things related to the 2007 administrative order. In the case of API, the district court found that what governs here is the subrogation doctrine. Subrogation is recognized in two separate provisions of CERCLA. It's a common law doctrine. The Supreme Court tells us to look to the common law in interpreting CERCLA, and Section 112C and Section 107E2 talk about the availability of subrogation claims. Now, the district court noted that in his opinion.
If you could clarify something for me, though. I thought, in which direction does this subrogation run? So if you're API, assuming, or Appvion, are you supposed to turn to NCR to get this $100 million-plus money reimbursed to you? I thought the subrogation went in the other direction, that it was API was the one who was actually manufacturing this paper, and they might have to subrogate, they might have to pay.
Well, the subrogation run, API stands in NCR's shoes. Whatever claim NCR has, and we submit that claim, is only
right,
Section 113 claim.
API is worried about its own claim. They're not worried about NCR's
claim. Right, they don't have a claim, as the Chubb decision in the district courts in California decisions hold. There is no independent Section 107 claim or 113 claim for someone who's essentially an insurer.
But why are they like an insurer? They didn't pay in their capacity as an insurer, though. They paid in their capacity as what they then understood from the district court orders is a PRP.
Well, they certainly could have. They had a contractual arrangement with NCR.
That's not why they were doing it.
No.
Surely.
They had a contractual arrangement with NCR, as Ms. Sullivan alluded. They have litigated this case hand in hand. They had an agreement to deal with their joint and common legal interests and to litigate the case as if one. That was their own agreement. That's what they projected to the outside world. The district court acknowledged that at A358 of his decision, one of his decisions, parties on all sides appeared to be operating under the assumption that Appleton Papers was liable under CERCLA. It was API that did not disclose until the Whiting litigation in 2008 that it had this arrangement with NCR. So API chose to step up, to participate in the response action, to be a very active player in the remedy. They could have if they chose. Certainly they did receive an order, and they were a recipient of an order and need to comply with it. But they could have stayed in the background and simply let NCR pay all the costs and then reimburse them per their agreement. They didn't do that. They chose to behave in a different way. But they did that in a way that projected themselves as a liable party. None of that, while interesting, changes their legal role. They are an indemnitor. They are a subrogee. That is their legal status. CERCLA recognizes that. The common law recognizes that the only claim they have is a...
I understand that they are now, but if you go back earlier, they were a PRP. And they paid as a PRP, not an indemnitor.
They're paying their own... Or they're, as a jointly and severally liable party, they are contributing to cleanup costs. So they're not indemnifying NCR for anything NCR, and NCR is paying plenty of money, and I'm sure they'd be glad to get contributions from anybody. But API wants its own, wants a chance to share its own expenses.
Well, if this court were to agree that they're not a liable party under CERCLA, that's all context. The baseline here is that their legal status, the only reason they're obligated to pay anything once they've been found not liable under CERCLA, is their contractual arrangement with NCR.
Well, that's why I asked Ms. Sullivan, is it just a private contract action?
Right. And if I may, with just one moment, there are implications to allowing them to have their own Section 107 case, which the Chubb court addressed.
Well, they were worried about double recovery, but I don't see where that's an issue.
Well,
here.
Double recovery is an issue, but there's a bigger issue, and it's a broader issue for the United States and the United States' ability to get settlements that lead to the early cleanups of Superfund sites and remediation in the way Congress intended. If an insurer standing out there on its own has its own 107 claim, a 107 claim, if it's for joint and several liability, is not subject to any equitable allocation. An insurer can then come in and sue other PRPs at a site in a way that its insured can't. It now has completely different and broader rights. So they can use that to pierce contribution protection in settlements with the government. They can use it as a shield to keep...
No, I understand, and you're out of time, but I guess if that's your big worry, it would be very easy to say that the vast majority of insurers are not identified by the government as PRPs up front. And whatever's happening in this case may be a little unusual for all I know. Maybe the government has a risk, you know, has an error rate of zero otherwise in designating PRPs. But if the error rate is anything more than zero, then this situation could come up again.
Well, and there is, of course, the Section 106 remedy if that were right. If that were necessary. But here, it's important that they projected themselves as a liable party at this case. They can't really fault the government for pursuing them as a PRP when that's exactly the way that they acted. But at the end of the day, they're only a party with subrogation rights.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks so much. So we have a little bit more from Mr. Chesler and Mr. Riggins.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very quickly. Number one, with respect to the court's focus on whether the district court should have considered other equitable factors other than culpability, I want to be clear about this. There was no discovery permitted on any other equitable factors. We never had discovery on it. We had discovery on the risk question, culpability, risk. That was the sole factor on which the court decided. We had no discovery on the other factors.
But didn't that discovery include your ability to probe the knowledge of risk that the other parties had?
Yes, it did. And I disagree respectfully with counsel's statement, which was pretty emphatic, that there was absolutely no evidence that they, in fact, knew anything. That's simply not so. There was evidence, and we never got the opportunity to try the case that would refer to that evidence. And one of the things the district court said was, I'm not going to consider the evidence of all the pollution that the others were putting into the river at the time, because it did not...
Well, thought that was immaterial.
Your Honor, it was material because it was that solid waste that carried the PCBs into the river. They were clinging to the solid waste that was dumped into the river when we had no facility on the river. Instead, the district court weighed our culpability for the earlier period of common ignorance entirely on our manufacturer status. Counsel said the big issue was we didn't tell ACPC to stop. That's in the later period, and I refer the court to A250, where the district court plainly said that in the earlier period, the party who makes the product is more likely to know than the party who uses the product, even though nobody knew. That's manufacturer liability. That's impermissible under the statute. Secondly, Your Honor, with respect to the second phase, the later period, there is no question about the materiality of culpability. That's the only factor the district court considered, and on that factor, he ignored the evidence we would have put forward and put in front of him.
Well, you called this to his attention.
And it's nowhere mentioned in the opinion. And lastly, with respect to the arranger issue, Your Honor, Mr. Mandelbaum stood here and argued the facts. He has a different view of the facts. He made those arguments to the district court. It all relates to the question of what the intent to dispose of was, not the fact that there was a hazardous substance embedded in the product that was also sold at the time. What was the seller intending to do when it sold it? There's not a single battery case they've cited which postdates Burlington. There's one Court of Appeals case that involves CERCLA. That's the Ninth Circuit case, which Judge Posner said he was dubious about in the GJ leasing case. The others are pre-Burlington District Court cases, and they involve reclamation. This was not reclamation. This is a multi-billion-dollar industry in the United States that is the engine that drives the paper industry. Multi-billion dollars. And in fact, Your Honor asked how much ACPC received at transcript 320 of the February 22nd session of the trial. There's testimony that it was something on the order of $1.5 million received for the sale of Broke by ACPC during the relevant period of time.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We must be getting there.
I got a free watch.
Does everybody get one?
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. This must mean we're getting near the end of the day. I want to address quickly points raised by Ms. Sullivan and by the government with regard to API's claim. First of all, the notion that API and NCR were married in 2008 when they brought this together, We had no choice at that point in time. We were not able to challenge the government's designation of API as a liable party, so we had to proceed as if we were at that point in time. The government argued that there was a triggering event at some point in time, and therefore that puts us into Section 113 forever. But the problem with that argument is contribution requires common liability. And at the point in time where you it's determined that you have no liability and you therefore have no common liability, the basis for contribution is gone.
So what's wrong with contract, as I was asking about?
The discussion about contract left me a little confused. I think the government was talking about one can assume and therefore get successor liability through contract. That didn't happen here. The district court determined that that did not happen here.
And these two companies at this point are and have been since maybe 1978 been totally separate corporations.
Are you referring to NCR and API?
Yeah.
They were always separate corporations. API bought assets in 1978 along with its then parent BAT. So in terms of a claim against the fund being the exclusive remedy, there's nothing in CERCLA says that that's an exclusive remedy. We tried it. The government blocked it. I would also add that if one looks at the statute, it indicates that you're not to resort to the fund while you're still actively pursuing PRPs. Fund is supposed to be your last resort. So the concern about, you know, any insurer can put themselves into this position. The government has full control over that. They don't put the insurer in API's position if they simply don't issue them a 106 order and call them a PRP. And B, certainly whatever opinion could be written by this court could be drafted in a form that is narrow enough to resolve any concern over that issue. So I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We will take the cases, both of them, under advisement. And the court will be in recess.